open synod, Hess, about quarter of on the 2nd. Present we have so far Senator Elton and myself, Chair Dyson. We will take up House Bill 214, and if the committee members, other committee members who are still hung up in finance get here, we'll probably vote it out today. And then we're going to open the hearing on House Bill 53 and allow it to be introduced and some folks to testify, and we will not be moving that bill today. It is an extensive bill, but everyone's here, and the committee members who aren't here will make sure that they get a copy of the transcript of your testimony that are here. So, Representative McGuire, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sure appreciate you hearing this bill today. This bill is technical in nature. It is a cleanup from the bill that you, along with Senator Elton and the member, frankly, all the members of your body supported last year, which created an anatomical organ and tissue registry within the state of Alaska. Prior to that, Mr. Chairman, as you know, you could go down to the Division of Motor Vehicles and ask to be an organ and tissue donor, and you might get a sticker on your license, but unless you were proactive, it never went any further than that. People had to go online or go to Life Alaska and go ahead and complete that registration, and many did not. So in working with the Division of Motor Vehicles and Life Alaska, we got that bill passed last year, and it's really been a fabulous addition, I think, to Alaska. So when you go in now, you get a hard on your hard copy license, and you're automatically registered. Again, it's voluntary, just emphasizing that. So we don't force people to be an organ and tissue donor, but when they do, we make sure that it counts. The bill before you is a cleanup. The bill was a fairly large bill, and we overlooked a couple of things. I'll just highlight a few of them and take questions. The definition of a technician was an example. We, under our bill last year, required that the technician be a licensed medical doctor. And then when we went back and looked at the federal language, we realized that our language was inconsistent. And then from a practical level, it was overly burdensome because the folks that really were the technicians that were assisting in the harvesting were highly trained folks, but they weren't medical doctors in every case. So that's a change. We also throughout changed the definition of procurement organization to allow for more inclusivity, and this is a really important thing for us. Right now, our own organ and tissue donation bank here in Alaska can't exercise control over the registry, and that was an our mistake in the late 11th hour of the of the session last year. We adopted a definition that left them out, and so throughout, that's the primary change to the bill. The other thing we did in the last committee that Senator Elton sat on in Senate State Affairs is we went ahead and removed some overly onerous burdens for the folks in the emergency medical system, those EMTs and folks that are the first responders. We had asked them to go ahead and notify hospitals that they were bringing in somebody who is an organ and tissue donor, and they just don't have the time or resources. I mean, they're busy trying to save lives. So what we did was we allowed them to delegate that responsibility to a dispatcher, which is the more appropriate place for that to be. And so that's kind of the heart of the changes that are made. But I'd be happy to take any questions. As I said before, it's a cleanup bill, and of all the bills that I have this session, this is the only one that really does need to pass before the end of the session, Mr. Chairman, in order for us to get this registry up and moving in a fully functional way that incorporates our own organ and tissue center. So with that, I'd submit the bill and ask for your support.
Thank you. In the last paragraph on page two of your sponsor statement, the second sentence, I don't understand what, for sure, what this refers to.
Trying to find my sponsor statement. Let's see here. There it is. Okay.
Page two.
Got it.
Last paragraph, second sentence.
Oh, yeah.
What's the this refer to? What in the first sentence does this and the second sentence refer to?
1452.
Yeah. Okay. And that section has to deal with federal language, CFR language. So what we're saying is that in the first sentence, we say, finally, there are two paragraphs within AS 1352 that will be repealed, the first being 1352-200B. It should say which, to be honest. It says this is. It should say which is in direct contradiction to 42 CFR, which requires,
right.
Yeah, my apologies. That's a.
It's all right. I'm nearly as dumb as I look.
It does look confusing, which is.
All right. Any other questions, Senator Elton? Anyone else here? I have one person that wants to answer questions. Is there anyone here who wants to testify on this bill? All right. Thank you.
Senator Mason, as always.
Maybe one of you two can stick around in case there's some questions come up, if and when the rest of my committee shows up. We'll set this bill aside. And now take up House Bill 53, another small little bill that makes technical corrections. Right?
Right. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Reneva Moss, legislative aide to Representative Coghill. This bill is, I think, the product of the reason Representative Coghill filed for office to begin with back in 1998. He sat in the LIO in Fairbanks for 3 days waiting to testify on House Bill 375. And after that process and after House Bill 375 passed, he decided it was time for him to become an active member of the political system, so he filed for office. This bill is a very lengthy bill. I could go through it section by section, but I think you probably would understand the bill better if I went through it by subject. This is a consolidation of four different bills, House Bill 53, House Bill 17, House Bill 113, and House Bill 114. 113 and 114 were bills introduced by the governor that dealt with opening the process and voluntary relinquishments. House Bill 17 was introduced by Representative Roteberg and was dealing with providing more information to legislators when they were trying to help families walk through the process or get information. Representative Coghill wanted to consolidate the bills because he wanted to make sure that there weren't four or five different bills out there that were overstepping each other, and at the end of the day you had bills that were actually conflicting with each other instead of complementing each other. So he met with the administration, Representative Roteberg, Representative McGuire, who was anticipating legislation, and they decided they would use House Bill 53 as the vehicle to do all of it. The section in 375 that brought Representative Coghill to the point of wanting to run for office was 4710960, which said there was no duty or standard of care for children in state custody. He felt that that language, although it was explained to him that it was fairly harmless language, to parents it was not harmless language because it said that they had a duty and standard of care at a certain level, and if they didn't abide by it, they would lose their children, but the state had no duty or standard of care. The purpose of the language was because they were adopting a lot of new timelines that were required by the federal standards, and they didn't want to be held liable if they couldn't meet those timelines. So in order for everybody to get what they wanted, we basically took the no duty language out and put in language that, that said what they meant. If they didn't follow the timelines, that in itself was not a reason for a civil liability. Another aspect of this bill is to strengthen families, to make sure that it's family members or family friends who are looked at first for placement of children that are taken into state custody. It also has a provision in Section 3 that says if parental rights are terminated and there's a family member already raising that child, the child there should be a preference for adoption with that family member. There's a lot of safeguards in this legislation for criminal background checks. It kind of reverses the cycle. Right now, it almost appears, although maybe it isn't that way, that family members or family friends have to prove they are fit for placement. This language turns the table around so that OCS would have to prove that they are unfit before they could deny them placement. It provides for the least restrictive placement in a close proximity of the parents so that they can, as good as possible, use some reunification processes and try to reunite the family. The preference placement is, first of all, an adult family member, second of all, a family friend, third of all, a licensed foster home, and then last resort would be an institution. It provides that OCS do all they can to provide parental visitation with the children, and if they're denied that visitation, then OCS would have to tell them why they were denied and tell them they have a right to a hearing. It establishes that poverty in itself is not a reason to deny placement with relatives. And I think you had the legislation several years ago that also that was the intent of that legislation.
I'm sorry, what was the intent?
That poverty in itself is not a reason to deny placement. I believe you had legislation several years ago that said poverty is not a reason in itself to terminate parental rights. This just extends that on to placement of relatives. It also provides that they cannot terminate parental rights solely on the basis that a parent could not get the treatment that was required by OCS in a plan, because there are cases where that treatment is not available. And under ICWA, OCS would have to make more of an effort to make sure that treatment was received by the parent. The bill also encourages OCS to train foster parents to be mentors. In the original version of the bill, we had legislation that would have prohibited them from placing a child in a foster home that is an adoptive home. And the thinking behind it was that we have some foster homes that are adoptive homes, that the foster parents have this preconception that they are taking these children because they're going to adopt them. And there's less of an inclination for them to mentor the parents for reunification if their end goal is to adopt the children. However, OCS explained to us there are times that those are the only homes that a child can be put in. So we didn't want to make it where it was going to be more difficult to place children into foster homes. And we changed the language so that we just encouraged mentoring. OCS would supply the training for the foster parents. The House Bill 53, we also wanted to try to deal with psychotropic drugs and the use of those drugs, making sure that the parents were involved in the decisions. So we changed the definition of major medical treatment to include medication for diagnosed mental health disorders.
Okay, and that one, you're talking about the birth parent when you say parents?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And if the child is in state custody, the birth parents still have the decision on the psychoactive drugs?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And if the department feels that the parent's decision is wrong, they would be required to go to court and make the judge decide.
Are there any other kinds of medical care that this bill requires the same procedure for?
Mr. Chairman, under existing statutes, there is a statute that requires parental consent for major medical treatment. The thing that was missing from that is that the use of these drugs was not included in that definition, so they could do it without a parent's permission. However, it's my understanding that current policy is that they do get the parent's permission.
Unless it's pregnancy-related, right?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
We may ask you, I had a preliminary discussion with Representative Coghill about whether or not you all would be open to add, they got to have the parent's permission for the child to travel out of state for medical treatment.
Okay. Did he give you a positive response?
Yes.
Okay.
And we'll work with you on that.
Okay. The next thing this bill does is it makes the process transparent. It opens to the public hearings involving China cases. We did put some sideboards on it so that the hearings could be closed. And this is part of the governor's bill. If the child could be stigmatized or emotionally damaged, the hearing could be closed. If it interfered with a criminal investigation, or if the disclosure would violate a state or federal law. It outlines what a person would be able to reveal from these public hearings. When a person walks into a China hearing that is public, the judge will issue an order that explains the person's part in the hearing, what their responsibilities are for confidentiality, and what the sanctions would be if they violated those. Originally, the sanction was that besides penalties, they could be barred from the proceedings of that particular China case. It was decided in finance that wasn't a good enough punishment. So if they violated that confidentiality, they would be sanctioned by being barred from any China hearings, regardless of who the parties were.
Senator,
thanks. Has that ever happened before? I mean, I know that you're opening up, but I mean, what is the likelihood that in fact, and we have a tough enough time trying to figure out whether a person is going to court-ordered drug and alcohol abuse training. I mean, it seems to me that what we're doing is we're asking the court to do something that may be quite difficult if they're going to bar somebody from any future China hearing.
Through the chair, Representative Elton, Senator Elkin, I'm not sure what your question is.
I guess what I'm asking is that reasonable to expect a court to keep track of somebody who may have violated confidentiality so that they're not allowed in a courtroom again if it's a China case? I mean,
through the chair, I might have Department of Law come up and answer that question, but I think the process would be that there would have to be a complaint filed with the court with an accusation that the confidentiality has been breached by an individual. So there would have to be another person that had the evidence that confidentiality was broke. For instance, there could be evidence. There could be a newspaper reporter that just wrote too much in a newspaper article, more than he should have, maybe disclosed the name of a party in the hearing. That would be a breach of the confidentiality because they can't disclose any information that could tie an individual to the facts of the case.
You have anything to add?
No. This bill sets up a grievance process for parents who feel that the case is not being handled properly. If they aren't happy with the results of the grievance investigation, they have the opportunity to go to a citizens review panel or a state review panel that could look at the case. We tie this review panel to the Open Meetings Act so that they would have the capability of meeting in executive session, which would be like the court closing a hearing. Again, to protect the identity of the parties in the case. And it would allow OCS to disclose confidential information under certain circumstances. One circumstance, of course, would be the Wasilla case that was high profile, but OCS was not allowed to comment on it because they are held to confidentiality. If a parent has disclosed confidential information about OCS's involvement to the public, OCS would be able to respond. When a perpetrator has been charged with a fine, actually I think that should say when a perpetrator has been charged with a crime, and if a report of harm had resulted in death or near fatality. In all three of those cases, OCS would be able to disclose confidential information to clear up their side of the story. And I must tell you, as a legislative aide for 11 years, the one thing I have learned is when you get a report from a constituent, there are always two sides to the story.
And Renee, I may have misunderstood, but when you were talking about the grievance process, you provided, or you said that there would be an opportunity to close a grievance hearing, and I forgot the reference.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, the grievance is an administrative process where they would file a complaint with the department, and they would look, the supervisors would look at the case and make a determination as to whether or not they thought the party had a valid complaint, and then act on that complaint. The state review panel is a panel of people who are appointed to the panel that will review the process, the procedures, the policies of the department, and make recommendations to the governor and the legislature on how to improve the process. However, another function of theirs would be to be like a hearing officer when the parent disagreed with the results of the grievance. That state panel is tied to the Open Meetings Act so that they could go into executive session to discuss the particulars of a complaint.
The reason I ask, Mr. Chair, is the Open Meetings Act provisions are different than, I'm looking at Section 10, where it applies to the reasons you can close a court hearing.
Right.
Where if it stigmatizes or could be emotionally damaging to a child, inhibit a child's testimony in that hearing, or disclose confidential, interfere with criminal investigation. Why wouldn't you want the same criteria to be applied at the hearing process?
The chair, Senator Elton, there is in the Open Meetings Act, and I don't have the cite with me, there is a provision where it states if a person's reputation could be tarnished by the information that's being released during that hearing, that it could go into executive session to protect that reputation.
That, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, would that cover stigmatization or emotional, mm-hmm. being emotionally damaging? Would that cover inhibit a child's testimony?
Through the chair.
Here with a criminal investigation, I'm not sure that.
I believe all of those would be an act of tarnishing someone's reputation, yes. You want to address that?
For the record, Stacey Crayley with the Department of Law, and through the chair, Senator Elton, you raise an interesting point, but I think that the discussion and the distinction is that a court hearing has a different process and different rules than a public meeting, and so that's what we were trying to address. And with respect to your specific question, the prohibitions or the exceptions under the Public Meetings Act with respect to executive session, as we look through them, and we felt that we would be able to protect the process, if you will, if there was information that needed to be discussed in a private nature, that there was enough